And of course, mine was, as we know, woody plants, landscape plants, and so on. And so often there were a whole series of meetings throughout the state, organized usually by the Hort agents, where I would be on the program.
So they would essentially invite you.
Yes, normally that's exactly the way it worked. And so I must say though that once in a while someone in a northern county would invite me to speak and there would be 12 people there. I made a little note in my little black book never to go back there again. But obviously, the most important counties were those in the southeast, Milwaukee, Waukesha, Racine, Kenosha, and in the Fox River Valley.
Oh, not over in La Crosse.
La Crosse was always a puzzle to me. They didn't have a Hort agent. And I suppose in some ways, they relied on Minnesota to some extent. But certainly almost all of my travel, whether it be to as a result of being involved with county extension people or nurseries, landscape architects, landscape contractors, arborists, would be in the populated areas. And so, then I worked also, of course, with the professional groups, the nurserymen, the landscape architects, landscape contractors, arborists, and so on. And indeed, a lot of their questions would come to me through correspondence or telephone. And I would be often a speaker on their conventions or meetings. The general public came in to an extent, and we really had to work hard to get the general public not calling directly to the University Horticulture Department, but to go to, through their county people. And so that was always a problem the whole time I was working.
The counties, I am assuming, though, were not billed for your services.
No, they were not. That's why it's cooperative extension.
This was just a service from the university, which was funded by the state.
Yes. And so I regularly did news releases. I was on the radio. Later on television, serving, because I had a responsibility to serve the state and the industries within the state. And so I was on the board of the Wisconsin, it's now called the Wisconsin Green Industry Association, previously it's called the, in any case, that's essentially it. It's the nurserymen, the florists, the landscape contractors all are a member of this overall association. So I represented the university on their board of directors for many years.
Now, Ed, suppose I were, or I had been the mayor of Wausau, and Wausau had decided to take a previously unused particle and turn it into a green space or create a municipal park or something. Would it be recommended to me that I be in touch with you out of the extension to help design something like that?
No, my expertise, I have had training in design. That's not something I ever dealt with. Now, the person I worked with very commonly on many, many, many programs was George Ziegler. And George was the a landscape architect in University Extension. And so we would often do a program where he would do the design part and then I'd follow up with the plant part. And that often occurred when not only giving lectures, but we would be called to a place who needed our services. One that I will always remember is Washington Island.
Oh.
One of the real movers and shakers there, I'm sorry I wouldn't be able to, I can't come up with her name right now, but she was the one who organized the park systems. She owned the Holiday Inn, not part of the chain by any means. It's called the Holiday Inn.
I know.
She had organized it was called a cherry train or something that took visitors around Washington Island. Well, because she was so involved in trying to get parks and development, George and I were there. So to meet with them and to make recommendations. And so George was a real character. He was a really good friend. And lo and behold, I had his son as a student too. And George had been a student of Bill Longenecker.
Oh, interesting.
So I worked with George a lot. On the other hand, perhaps I worked more often with the extension specialist from entomology and plant pathology. So I would be the expert on the plants and then the diseases and insects of these plants, always of great concern. Mm-hmm. And of course, so we had, for a long time, we had a series of landscape maintenance meetings. And the ones I remember the most is that I would go to Fond du Lac and do my show with usually one other person. And then while I was doing that, maybe Gail Wharf and Chuck Koval would be up in Green Bay. We would change places the next day. I would stay overnight in, I was volunteered to go to Green Bay first because I would then go out to dinner with some of my friends up there. Mm-hmm. And so I would, rush back to Fond du Lac for the afternoon program. And then that same program we would present probably in Kenosha and in Milwaukee County as well.
Would you say you were on the road every week with the extension?
Not as much as a lot of other extension people. There are a lot of extension people who were 100%. And even had a car provided. I always drove my own car. Mm-hmm. I had classes to teach.
Right.
So I couldn't stay overnight and come back the next morning, usually. So I had a lot of late night drives home.
Yeah.
But to tell you the truth, I enjoyed working with professionals, say nurserymen, landscape contractors, et cetera, more than I did students, I think. I don't know, because their maturity, that they were really eager for what I had to offer. I remember Latin American landscape contractor who, the year I retired, when I was saying goodbye in Milwaukee County, he came up to me and told me, he said, I was his education.
Wow.
And a few other situations very much like that.
Yeah.
Also family up in Green Bay, I remember telling me the same thing when I retired.
Ed, were you busier with Extension during the summers?
That's when I was able to travel a lot more. That's where I really worked with nurseries a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They were disappointed if I didn't come around once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to keep abreast of what was going on and being helpful whenever I could.
Ed, you were talking about entomologists, and it makes me think of a few years back, there was this gypsy moth infestation of around here.
Yes.
Would you have been involved in plagues like that in different parts of the state?
I wouldn't have been personally. A lot of that, of course, was handled by the DNR. But the you've certainly heard about Phil Pelletieri.
Mm-hmm.
Phil, I've worked with all those years. He's still active, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But he would be the person involved. But let's say when we were dealing with Dutch elm disease,
mm-hmm.
or today with the ash, emerald ash borer,
mm-hmm.
then it would be a group of us at presenting meetings about what we can do, what we can expect. I would probably talk about diversity and suggested new plantings.
And Dutch elm disease, you still can't plant elms, right?
We can. And interestingly, of course, the main approach has been the development of elms that are resistant to the Dutch elm disease. And those programs were University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Morton Arboretum, and the USDA. And most of that work was done in a laboratory in Delaware, Ohio. And so resistant elms were developed. None of them had any American elm in them at all.
Really?
They're primarily Asiatic species, which were by nature resistant. And then they were hybridized to create plants that were had a better form or had resistance to some of the other foliar diseases. And so of all of these, there have been a lot of them, and I've evaluated all of them.
Yeah.
The two I would rate best today, one came from the Morton Arboretum, one came out of the UW breeding program. Now, more recently, there have been really three American elms that have been selected and named, released, that are resistant to the Dutch elm disease. And so, because of that, we are now planting American elms.
But not the way I remember them from my youth.
No, and we shouldn't.
Yes.
We shouldn't ever do that. And interestingly, one of the best of these is called the Princeton elm, which was introduced by Princeton Nursery many, many years ago, before Dutch elm disease ever came along, on the basis of its wonderful branching habit, and just happened to be resistant. And by the way, I've Princeton Nursery in New Jersey. The owner was a very close friend of mine over the years, and his son came to be a student of mine.
Ed, recall when you were talking about white spire birch, I think,
and yes,
that you identified one that was naturally resistant. Is that the same phenomena with the Princeton elm?
Yes, that's right. That's right. Just in that case, just it turned out that it was, wasn't selected originally on that basis.
Now, what about the ash borer? What's happening there?
Well, it it is fatal. When I first saw it, it was in Detroit. I have a very close friend living in Detroit that I made through the American Conifer Society. And I went to visit him several years back. I couldn't believe what a sad scene this was. All of these dead ash. And not only were they dead, but they were resprouting at the base and looking really trashy. And of course, the economic impact of this is incredible. And so now people like me and entomologists particularly are grappling with, what do we do? Do we take them down before they're, just to get rid of them now so that we don't have, we aren't overwhelmed financially with this, this removal and replanting? A good example here, State Department of Agriculture asked me, we have a wonderful collection of ash.
In the state?
Or no, in this garden, in the Longenecker Gardens.
Longenecker Gardens.
That is as good as anywhere. State Department of Agriculture approached me and they said they wanted to apply for a grant to help preserve this collection. Well, my response was, we're not in the business of preservation. I want to find out whether any of these possess some resistance. And there's a good possibility because we have a Manchurian ash out there that comes from the same area of the emerald ash borer and presumably is resistant.
Oh, really? How interesting.
Unfortunately, I don't think it's a very beautiful tree. Doesn't have any nice fall color like our American ashes do. But then the last ash I planted, there's one out there that is a hybrid between the Manchurian ash and our native black ash. And it has wonderful fall color. It's too soon to tell what kind of form it's going to have. But who knows? Maybe it'll be resistant. But we're going to watch the others die. However, out there is also a very important ash that Bill Longenecker introduced. Bill Longenecker had noticed an ash on the campus in front of the Home Economics Building as having a, as first of all, being male. You want male white ashes because they don't produce lots of weedy seedlings all over. It has a, had a beautiful form and fabulous fall color. Orange and maroon, and then the interior is gold.
Oh yeah, I remember that tree.
Well, it's gone now, unfortunately. So Bill Longenecker brought that to the attention of McKay Nursery. And so it was named Autumn Purple White Ash. It has become the most popular white ash in the world. And so when Bill Longenecker died, McKay Nursery donated an Autumn Purple White Ash for me to plant in the garden.
Oh, lovely.
And Bill Longenecker's ashes are spread beneath it.
Oh.
And later, his widow's ashes are spread beneath it. And so without my really saying much about it, the Arboretum people say we're going to try to preserve that tree.
And do you support that?
I do. On the historical basis. Mm-hmm. So whatever the entomologist recommend in terms of treatment, it'll be treated. And we'll watch the others die. Hopefully not a couple of them, though, that might show some resistance.
And is the emerald ash borer, is that confined to the upper Midwest, or is it?
No, it started in the Detroit area, really, and entered Wisconsin, I suppose, maybe 6 years ago or something like that. And it's in Janesville.
Oh, it is already?
That's the closest to us. Oh, it's on the, it's in some place on the Mississippi River. It's in Ozaukee County. It's, I don't know, five or six locations. And so it's just, it's probably here already. We haven't detected it. Mm-hmm. So there are always those sort of crisis things that we've dealt with over the years. Mm-hmm. I guess getting back to extension, one of the more recent, more toward the end of my career, this whole Master Gardener program mm-hmm. came into being. Curiously, that was started in the state of Washington by one of my fellow grad students.
Really?
And, you know, as in every state, I think, now, the whole idea is that instead, the part of this grew out of this idea of all these people calling the department mm-hmm. with their problems and questions and taking up our time. Let's engage other people in helping out. And so the Master Gardening Program came to Wisconsin. And so I did a lot of Master Gardener training, and this was going out. That was Moore County. The best counties were still those with hort agents, because they really had someone who was putting together a good training program for them. Dane County was always filled, totally filled with, that turned people away from the program. Still do, I think. In any case, one of the things that I was asked to do, they decided that in terms of the USDA, the Cooperative Extension, decided that for the Midwest, we should develop a series of videos for training, so that instead of me going out to X county and giving a presentation, they can look at my video. And so the first one for the for the North Central region was done in Iowa. That was done on fruits or vegetables. I forgot what it was. So I was asked to do the second one on landscape plants. That was about a year before I retired, as I remember. And so Shelley Ryan, we'll talk more about her following this. Shelley Ryan was chosen to be the producer of this. She was herself a master gardener. And so she, in this video that we put together, she and I interacted. She was the master gardener, and I was the expert on what we were talking about. Selecting landscape plants is what it was. And so that was used throughout the North Central region. And then following that, then Shelley got this into doing the Wisconsin Gardener TV program. Mm-hmm. Guess who she turned to, I don't know how many times.
I can't guess.
And that was all after I retired. And I think I listed a number of them on there, but I didn't have a total, there are some I'm missing there. In any case, she was so nice to work with, and she was such a nice, I couldn't say no to her ever. So we did all of them out here. So of course we did one on crab apples, we did one on lilacs, we did one on conifers, on and on. Magnolias, I'm sure we did one. And now, you know, she's cancer and is retiring, and I think this may be the end of it. And then also that grew out of that was the Garden Expo. Really big thing. That's because of, all because of Shelley.
Yeah, there are key people, aren't there?
Yes.
Who turn out.
Yes.
At the right circle.
So I had done a little other television work before that, but that was mainly after retirement, majority of it.
I think I saw a clip or two of that.
Yeah, well, if you watch Channel 21, you'll see she comes on and advertises things regularly. There are always people, all of these programs that I've done have been repeated, I don't know how many times. People are always saying, oh, I saw you on TV last night. I said, what was I talking about? Well, it was something I'd done years ago.
Yeah. How did I look? How did I
So I guess, and of course, later on, a lot of these horde agents were former students of mine, and are not necessarily my own students, but had gotten their master's degree in the department. And so it was a pleasure to work with them also.
And how did the extension change during the course of your career there? If it did, how did it change and how did it affect your work?
I think in earlier days, it was sort of folksy. The more rural kind of orientation. And then we got more sophisticated. And so we had horde agents, people who were trained very specifically in that that area. And then because of that, then the professionals, the nurserymen, the greenhouse growers, the sod growers, the arborists, all of these people relied more and more on us for their educational programs. And so I think especially as this may be true with arborists, if a city in Wisconsin had a what was called a city forester, there's a good chance that person didn't have a degree.
Oh, really?
In the earlier days.
Oh, in the earlier days.
Yes. Where today almost all do. And a part of their education was provided also by UW Extension. The Arborist Association, which they made me an honorary member early on, which I did numerous programs over the years, is the one that is still, they have no paid people in their organization. Everything is volunteer. But a lot of these, about half the members are municipal arborists, which they do this as part of their job, you know, organization, planning meetings, all that kind of stuff. And so some of them are private arborists, others are municipal arborists, and some are educators like me and whatever. But they are the one group that has not joined the other green industry groups in this Green Industry Association.
Ed, are you at all concerned, given the current climate of public funding of various services, if that's going to have a significant effect on municipalities and other units of government that are addressing horticultural issues?
Well, yeah, I think right now almost every municipality is worried. How are they going to handle this this ash crisis? The city of Milwaukee has been a real leader. They've had some good people there.
Really? In Milwaukee?
In Milwaukee. This is Milwaukee County is what the program is. But Bob Sciarra, who is the person who really made it a business to deal with the city forestry program, that he knew a lot about budgeting, about training, about planning ahead. His son was my student. you and I think of Milwaukee as sometimes being way behind in a lot of things, but they were really forward in this area. And actually before Dick Rideout, before he came to the DNR, he was with Milwaukee County Forestry.
Now, Milwaukee County and city both had, or did have, a great park system.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Well, I of course have always related a lot to Berner Botanical Garden, which is part of the Milwaukee County system. Mm-hmm. John Voigt, who was the long-term director, was a very close friend of mine. He was sort of like a Bill Longenecker of that vintage, little younger, but John. Was very special to me. And when John retired, things totally fell apart. And one of the most serious things there has been, up until I think just now, they never allowed volunteers. The union was so strong that they would not permit the use of volunteers.
Oh dear.
I personally feel that no public garden can survive without a volunteer program. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, they now have a strong program over at Berner, Friends of the Berner. And I guess finally, through this Friends program, that must be how the volunteer program works. So I have seen the Milwaukee County parks grow up to buckthorns. And, you know, it's sad.
Yeah.
Because they were one of the best
in the country,
in my early days. Yes.
That was sort of a product of the progressive Germans, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
You know, I think of Frank Zeidler as mayor.
Well, we'll stay out of politics a little bit.
Yes.
However,
that was
always a big disappointment to me. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is the point where I should mention my involvement with the pain in Oshkosh. It was it came to my attention as the Payne Art Center and Arboretum. And of course, if there's an arboretum in Wisconsin, I have to know something about it.
Right.
And so I made contact there, and the gardener, his name was Mark. I can't say his last name right now. The gardener for Mr. Payne was still there. The Paynes had died. No, Mr. Payne had died. Mrs. Payne had. Mrs. Payne was a Kimberly.
Oh.
And so the mansion was built as their home, but turned out they never lived in it. And it was built in with the intention of it being open to the public with their art collection. And so I got to know Mark, who was the gardener, and particularly George Nevitt, who was a relative of the Paines, and he was on the board. And so nothing was labeled there. And so I offered to come up on a Saturday once in a while and help them out.
In your role at the extension?
No, this is just on my own on a Saturday, just to help them out and to get started. And so, which they much appreciated. And I didn't do it that many times, but so I got to know them all there. And I got a phone call one day and said, Mark died last night. We've got to replace him. I said, well, after a little bit, I thought about it. I think I've got just the student to do it. This is John Green, who is hadn't graduated yet.
Oh.
So John went up there on weekends to work and for them to get to know him. And so they hired him as the horticulturist at the Paine. John absolutely transformed that place.
Really?
And he had a number of my students who were interns there, and he was great at working with interns. By the way, I could also get into this intern thing. I was a great promoter of interns for our students.
Oh.
I felt it was absolutely essential that they do it. And so I promoted other places to have interns and take our students. In any case, it turned out that John had absolutely transformed this place. John did such an outstanding job. He was attracted to Kohler.
Oh.
And he was in charge of Kohler Landscape. The whole Kohler enterprise.
Oh my.
Herb Kohler would call John in the middle of the night with some big inspiration that they're going to build a new golf course. And this and John and Herb Kohler just hit it off and did everything. And then turned out that John's wife Sue, who I knew so well, got hired as the head of hospitality for all of their American Club, and mm-hmm. John designed the landscape of the American Club, by the way.
Oh, did he?
Well, then what happened is Sue got lured to Williamsburg, head of hospitality, and so that's where they are now.
Is he in, working as a horticulturist?
Or? Well, he was he was really working with Colonial Williamsburg and also with an arboretum in the area. But John has developed, had diabetes. They found out when he went into the Air Force and he was discharged because of it. He is practically blind. He's had 12 surgeries on his eyes and so, he literally has not had a job since they went to Williamsburg.
Oh, that's sad.
But he was here at my 80th birthday.
Was he?
Yeah. In any case, so the Paine got to know me. And so when I had announced my retirement, the horticulturist there, who I didn't really know that well, asked me whether I would consider serving on the board, mainly to support him. And so I agreed. And I later wished I hadn't, because it was a nuisance driving 90 miles one way to board meetings. But I met some very interesting people. The two things I accomplished there, one, I got them talked into changing the name of the place from Payne Arts Center and Arboretum to Payne Arts Center and Gardens. It wasn't an arboretum on, well, it was 10 acres of land or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. The term arboretum, people don't know, it turns off a lot of people. They know what a garden is. So
arboretum carries a scientific stigma.
Yeah, and young people don't necessarily know, even have any idea what it is. Mm-hmm. But they've heard of a garden. The other was that this was Mr. Payne's garden, and it was time really to do a master plan, well past that. John Green had done a lot there, but it was then, you know, it was time to do a master plan. So I talked them into doing a master plan and pulled that off. And so it's a very special place, really.
I've never been. I'm not sure I'm much aware of it.
Well, go there sometime. It's in downtown in Oshkosh. Nathan Payne invented the hollow door.
Oh.
And it was made in Oshkosh. And so the Payne factory is right there on the river, and the arboretum included the Payne factory originally. It's now very fancy condominiums, and so he and Jesse Payne, Jesse Kimberly, amassed a fortune and decided to build this mansion, and that it should. And they had collected art for years, and with the whole idea of displaying their art. So I ended up being on the board for 9 years in the process of the master plan, I ended up donating quite a bit of money, thanks to our son, and they're still after me for money, but I'm
sure.
I want to support the local. Our local things.
I wanted to ask you something about this.
You're as bad as I am.
Worse. This is what I'm supposed to do for my living. it's gone. Maybe this is good, since you were talking about that, to ask you about the.
The Bickelhaupt Arboretum. I was quite active in the AABGA, the American Association of Botanic Gardens and Arboretum. And at some point, I've got to draw in Catherine Bradley into all this also, the director of the Arboretum.
Yes, actually, maybe we'll have to do that in the next session.
Well, yeah, I think so.
I'm going to ask you about the management.
Catherine was partly, maybe with some of my encouragement, became very actively involved with the AABGA. Mm. And so we traveled to meetings together quite often, and she and I, by the way, I should say that, and I'll repeat it. I have never been so impressed with an administrator as I was with Catherine Bradley.
Really?
I was stunned by how effective she was.
Huh.
She was just amazing. She was also a person with presence. So when Catherine stood up, you noticed. And I must tell you, when we traveled and we would not stay in the same room, but at a motel or a motel where they'd have a breakfast. It's funny old Catherine I've got to have a proper breakfast. So we'd have to go to a restaurant. I enjoyed her enormously.
And was she as extraordinary as she was formidable?
She was. She was. Well, back to that was this got off me on the AABGA track. Well, in any case, at AABGA meetings, I had met this couple from Clinton, Iowa, Bob and Fran Bickelhaupt. And Bob always sat in the front row of every meeting, absolutely always. And so, and I guess we maybe had lunch or dinner together and a couple times. And so I got to know them. And so Betty and I and the kids, we planned a trip down the Mississippi River. And so I let them know that we'd stop.
So this is a ways back, if you're
when John was, I remember, the connection I remember is that we were in Hannibal, Missouri, taking a boat trip, and John must have been about 9 years old. He was tearing around on the boat. Over the loudspeaker, the captain said, "Young man," John was so embarrassed. "Young man, there will be no running." In any case, we had been at the Bickelhaupt, and Bob and Fran had planned a lunch for us in the amphitheater. This is a little area of the Arboretum. And we just had a very pleasant time with them. And I think the next week I had a letter asking whether I would serve on the board. And I agreed and did ever since, still am on the board. And so it involves an annual meeting. And so I've really seen the transformation and the development of that arboretum. Bob and Fran, well, they were very successful. Both of their parents were wealthy people in the community. And then Bob had a truck dealership. And he sold more trucks in the Midwest than anybody else. And in any case, they made a lot of money. And they decided that they would like to start an arboretum. No, I think what they wanted to do initially, this all was related to Dutch elm disease.
Oh.
They wanted to work on their community's trees. So they went to the Morton Arboretum to classes.
Huh.
And in the process of this, they met the propagator at the Morton Arboretum. They decided that they would turn their place into an arboretum for the public enjoyment.
Their land.
Their land, yes. And so they hired the propagator, and it was a very close friend of mine as well. Well, I can't say his name right now. In any case, they hired him to do their master plan. Well, they didn't call it a master plan, but their plan of the plantings. And the Morton Arboretum really provided a lot of the plants for them,
oh,
for this new arboretum. And so Fran, they were in their 50s when they did this. Fran did all the mowing of the whole place. And Bob was very much involved in everything there. And they always hired a young person to really do the maintenance. And Bob had a hotline. Anybody in the community could call him, and he would go out and look at their trees or help them in whatever. And so it was... the family members who are on the board. A plant pathologist from Iowa State, and trying to think who else professionally. That might have been it at the beginning. In any case, later on, I encouraged them to have my counterpart at Ames on the board, which he is, and I just pleased to be able to see him a couple times a year. Mm-hmm. And now the a landscape architect from Ames is also on the board. But it went through some odd times. They hired one of my former students as a horticulturist. And then they decided they should have a director other than Bob and Fran. So they hired their son-in-law.
Uh-oh.
You're right. So the son-in-law was a total disaster, which ended up in my former student leaving because of him. The Bicklehops disowned their daughter and son-in-law and family in the process. And both of the, especially Fran, you don't want to get on the wrong side of her. She's 96 and going strong, yeah. She thinks I could never do it wrong, of course. She'll accept anything I recommend. Well, in any case, it's after Bob had a stroke, they reestablished contact with their daughter. She moved back and took over. And she's another Catherine Bradley. She is so skilled. And before I could see the community resenting the Bicklehops, these wealthy people who want to sort of, you know, make people happy with this arboretum, where there was no community involvement at all. They had one volunteer. Well, Francie came in and got everybody in the community involved, all kinds of wonderful programs. She developed, in addition to the board, what she calls a roots board of community people. Nobody from the community were ever on the board before. Her dentist, her attorney, and so they've got this wonderful volunteer program going now. One of the board members, who is also a good friend of mine, who was very much involved in the American Conifer Society, talked them into doing a planting of dwarf conifers, talked them into buying some more land where this is. It's now the Heartland Collection of dwarf conifers, well known everywhere. So this little arboretum that Bob and Fran started, this is known all over, this Heartland Collection. And so, Francie has now retired, and she's still the president of the board, which is great. And so in all these years I've been there, at some point they hired a young man who had graduated from the technical college. His name is David Horst, who was so shy he could not give a tour to a group at the Arboretum. He was, you know, just this kid from a farm in Iowa. Well, I have seen him grow to the point where he's learned so much from me. He will give talks, he gives tours. He is committed to being there the rest of his life.
He's not trained as a horticulturist.
Yes, he was at the vocational school, 2 year of vocational school. And they decided that instead of having a director, they will have a program director who is equal with the horticulturist, this David, who, by the way, I can't get him to call me Ed. I'm Dr. Hasselkus, always will be, and always has been. So he is on equal footing. We didn't want to bring in someone who was superior to David because we're so pleased with him.
Oh.
So we now have a program director who works so well with him. And she's very good at involving the community. So it's an interesting place. There again, I pushed to get a master plan. And they've been very slow about spending any money to carry it out.
Ed, I know what I was going to ask you about the pain. It came back as you were talking about it, which is, what exactly is a master plan? What are the issues involved in creating one, and how difficult is it?
A master plan is done by a landscape architect. And both of these, by the way, were done by the same person, a former student.
Really?
Yes.
Who was that?
Dennis Bittner of Fox Point.
Okay.
He's one of my very first students and has done many arboreta and botanical gardens. So it's done by a landscape architect.
Okay.
So the layout of the entire facility, but also the relationships of where you get out of your car, what do you do next? How are you properly introduced to the place? It's been fun for me to watch these kinds of master plans being put into effect. So a good example at the Payne, here's the parking lot. Before, you just got out of the car and started walking around. Now there is a pavilion through which every visitor passes. So goodbye world, hello Arboretum. Mm-hmm. Hopefully people will sign the guest book, but most of them don't. And I talked Francie into putting up a banner each season. Welcome spring, welcome whatever. So there is a definite, not really a trail, but a definite, if you turn right, you sort of make the 1 mile pathway through the Arboretum. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of anything that, a couple other things. There were open spaces that are sort of amorphous in form. Dennis created a perfect oval in this one with a long vista. Through the plantings. And then in another area, oh, then there, we talked about this this amphitheater, mm-hmm. which is way far from the parking lot, and the Bickelhops had hired someone to make some lovely benches for it to put in the amphitheater. Well, Dennis said, well, these welcome, the benches ought to be where people arrive. So are these school groups that want an orientation, mm-hmm. it's right at, they come through the pavilion to the, and so now these benches are there where any group that comes for a visit gets their orientation right there. It was all in the full sun. So of course what we did is provided shade for this area. Roy Nordine was the propagator at the Morton Arboretum, who did their original planting layout. Well, Roy did all the lilacs in a row and various other things in rows. Not terribly interesting. And so there are no, after Dennis got finished, there were no rolls left. And so so it was an interesting process for me to observe. Mm-hmm. And so something that hasn't happened, and I don't know that they're ever going to be willing to spend the money on it, but basically the site has the rock stream, brook or running through it, which is very nice because there's a lot of meanders around. Rock Creek is what it is, through the entire arboretum. And so that's a low area, and it got high on two sides. This is Iowa, but this is close to the Mississippi, you see.
I was going to ask you what the topography yes. was like and if it were interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is very interesting. So across this valley then, at the two high spots, Dennis has indicated what he calls a belvedere or a tower that you go up into so that you can view the arboretum. And you look from one to the other. One addresses the other, as Dennis has a way of saying. And so one is supposed to be masculine in appearance, the other feminine in appearance.
Oh,
so there's Bob and Fran. Well, when Bob died, I made a contribution to a belvedere, but it's has never happened. So it's a very interesting place, and it's now the home is there, which is just in the way sort of, but that's where Fran is still living. So what is the future, mm-hmm. and is there a long time for the future? I think in the deed it says that it at some point if it would be given to the city if it is no longer an entity or something like that.
Is there sufficient Bickelhaupt money to sustain it indefinitely?
Apparently, but and because of that, well, maybe not. And who knows what the future is like? Mm-hmm. They have been so determined that no other money goes into it. Francie wants to apply for grants, all this kind of stuff. Well, I think we're softening up Fran. Fran listens to me. Maybe if I tell her it's got to happen, it'll happen.
You're going to stay on there for a while.
Well, I don't know. I've been sort of suggesting that maybe it's time for me. It's a hard drive for me to make, and so now Betty's got to go with me, really, to share the driving.
But it seems to me, listening to you, there's a certain affection that you see.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. For everybody there.
Yes. Yeah. So where is it? Clintonville?
Clinton, Iowa, which is just over the Mississippi from Illinois. It's about a 2.5 hour drive for me.
Is it close to Dubuque?
No, it's south of Dubuque.
South of Dubuque.
Okay. It's between Dubuque and the Quad Cities, essentially.
Okay, all right.
Well, on the Mississippi River.
And is it fairly well known?
The Arboretum?
Yeah.
Especially so because of the Heartland collection of dwarf conifers. Mm-hmm. Everyone in the American Conifer Society knows about it.
Mm-hmm. And do people, would you say people from the Midwest come to see it?
Yes, it's, you know, there are these like tourist magazines and things. It's often been highlighted in these.
Mm-hmm. So you have really left a mark.
Well, in a sense.
Not just at the Arboretum. I'm thinking about your students and what people have learned.
Well, and I've essentially been the curator at the Bickelhoff, too. Although now another board member is a sales rep from Isley Nursery, and he's really taken over the conifer area, which is the important one. Mm-hmm. So he comes there couple times a year, and with David Horst, they decide what plants have to go, what's got to be moved, what's got to be planted. So I've kind of been able to stay out of that.
And Ed, are you doing anything anymore with Morton?
Not in a very formal way. I mentioned that Chris Bochtel is the director of collections there. I get an email from him about once a week.
Oh, I would say that's pretty involved.
We have regular exchanges about things there. Mm-hmm. I don't get there very often. And one of the things when I was teaching there for 3 years after I retired, gave me a good excuse to actually get there. But I've been more involved at the Chicago Botanic Garden really than at the Morton in recent years.
And where is the Chicago Botanic Garden?
It's north of Chicago trying to think of the Glencoe.
I think I stopped there once.
It's a wonderful place.
Yeah.
Well, there, I didn't mention it, Chris Jarantowski has been the director for many, many years, former student. He didn't get a master's with me. I encouraged him to go to the University of Minnesota, where he got his master's degree. And so he's involved me in a lot over the years.
And while we're talking about your work on the Payne and Bickelhoff and other arboretum and gardens, it provokes me to ask you about the Allen Centennial Gardens here on campus, how they came about and what your role was in that and what you think of it now.
Throughout my years with the horticulture building, behind the horticulture building, we had the horticulture garden, which was designed by Bill Longenecker. And I have a picture of somebody took of our class, Bill Longenecker, and we were out there in that garden, and I'm busily talking with one of the other students, not paying any attention to Bill Longenecker. In any case, when it came time to expand our building, the horticulture building, the first idea was, well, we're going to tear down the dean's house, mm-hmm. and build the hort building there.
Oh, really?
And also on where the tennis courts were, right, mm-hmm. there. And so that was the recommendation. And I think I was one of those who said, wouldn't it make a lot more sense to add on to this building? And that's what eventually happened. Mm-hmm. Goodbye, horticulture garden, because of the addition.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't know who proposed that possibility of using that site of the dean's house, but it was decided upon. And Gail Beck, who had been my undergraduate professor, my graduate professor, was assigned to be in charge.
And the grounds, I assume, were still lawn and landscape to
serve the yes, dean's house? Not to any, nothing very elegant. I used to come by there with my, when I'd have my class out, and Emeritus Professor, President Fred would give me tomatoes from his garden. And so, anyway, that was the decided is where the garden should be. So we had a committee of the Horticulture Garden Committee, of which I was a member. Right now, I can't remember everyone who was on it. Obviously, Gail Beck was in charge, and I'm sure Dick Tipple was on it. He was the campus landscape architect. Maybe someone was on from landscape architecture, I'm not sure. In any case, we had this committee, which we met regularly and made the decisions and hired the people. And after a few years, the committee sort of disappeared.
Is this the mid-70s or in the 80s?
Probably a little later than that. Right now, I can't remember. I'm hazy on dates.
Okay.
In any case, ultimately, Gail Beck retired, and his replacement was Dennis Stimmert. And Dennis Stimmert, that was part of his, when he was hired, this was part of his responsibility to be in charge of it, which he accepted. And but it became, I think, just sort of Dennis Stimmert's domain, and no more committee meetings. So there was no more input, really, from, and of course I had retired at somewhere along there too. Mm-hmm. And so Bill Hoyt was hired as the, I think he referred to himself as the head gardener. Bill Hoyt was very good at in the construction phase. He could jump on a backhoe and do all these kinds of things, but he didn't know one plant from another. And so I was relieved when he retired. And so then also after it, I don't remember who made any of the original planning decisions, but Dennis Bittner was hired. We've talked about Dennis before.
Yes.
And so Dennis was hired to do a master plan. And there again, it was so much fun for me to see how a master plan emerges and comes into being. And I thought he did an absolutely magnificent job. Mm-hmm. So he, well, one or two of the things that I was so impressed with, he divided the garden into two sort of zones. One that was could be private for a wedding, for other events. Mm-hmm. The other zone was then always open to the public, so that it wasn't closed to the public. He also this idea of various garden rooms, which I was acquainted with from the English gardens, of course. Mm-hmm. And so, and there he had the responsibility to work in some fruits for the fruit program in the department, some vegetables for the vegetable part of the department, and then of course the woodies and the herbaceous ornamentals. And so basically my role in it was that Dennis Bittner specified tree, small tree, shade tree, weeping conifer, spire-like conifer. Well, I chose all the woody plants. And I tried to include those that, like the autumn purple white ash, mm-hmm. white spire birch.
Good.
Those that had a Wisconsin connection. Mm-hmm. That was my major role in the garden of selecting the woody plants that were to go into it. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we had to deal with what should go in there and what shouldn't. But in working with Dennis Bittner, perennial garden was the place designated for weddings. And so at the end of the garden is this sort of a pergola, but with a gate in the back for access, all white flowered plants in around this wedding pergola. And then Dennis also came up with a couple antique things, a finial for this wedding structure, mm-hmm. And other things around there. What else was I going to say? That in any case, it was fun seeing how it was developed.
Do you have any role now? Are you on any sort of
oversight
committee?
None at all. No. So after I retired, I really had no role in it at all.
Mm-hmm. I used to go eat lunch there.
Many people have told me that. It's been wonderful for people on campus.
Oh, it really has.
Yes.
I love it in the fall, I have to say.
Yes.
Spectacular. I like spring stuff, but the fall, whatever they do there, it's quite wonderful.
Yes. Well, I think the part of the fun part was that Dennis did an Italian garden and various themed gardens that you went through, which is special.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll just conclude this.
Yeah.
This now concludes the second interview with Edward R. Hassapis, Emeritus Professor. This interview was recorded on February 28th, 2013.